It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What's your compulsion? That thing you can't stop doing could be something ordinary, like checking your phone every 5 minutes. Or it could be something more unusual.
So Shala Nicely has classic OCD.
Science writer Sharon Begley.
She became convinced, for no obvious reason, that her cat Fred was in the refrigerator. So she opened the refrigerator once, and no, there was no cat inside. But then her brain got this itch. What if Fred was actually behind the gallon container of milk? Maybe I just didn't see him. She opened it again. Still no Fred. She would go away. She would tell herself, no, he's not there. And then the thought would come back. And then she thought, well, maybe, you know, he has quantum teleported into the fridge when my back was turned. So she opened the refrigerator again. This is a very intelligent woman, but it consumed the better part of a day for her.
Shala managed to get over that particular compulsion, but some of the more classic OCD symptoms can be a lot harder to get rid of. Needing to wash and rewash your hands dozens of times a day, checking and rechecking. Did you lock the door?
Did you lock the door?
Did you turn the lights off?
Did you check the lights?
Or at the more extreme end, hoarding or compulsive shopping. But the thing is, we all share this tendency. And in her new book, science journalist Sharon Begley argues that compulsions are not eccentric quirks limited to obsessive germaphobes or reclusive hoarders, but things many of us do every day without even realizing it.
Right, and that's really one of the messages that I really hope readers take away from the book, that just because you have a compulsion, just because you engage in a compulsive behavior, does not mean that your brain is broken. It could instead, and in many cases does mean, that you have found a way to alleviate anxiety. One of the things that was so difficult as I was beginning the research and reporting for the book was just pinning down experts to explain what a compulsion is. Compulsions are driven by anxiety. There's either a little tickle in your brain or a deep, deep fear that something is about to go wrong or has gone wrong. And the compulsion is the way that you get rid of that anxiety.
Was there for you a single moment or experience that made you want to write this book and made you think about how some of this compulsive behavior isn't just extreme, but is stuff that you see, we all see around us every day?
Yes, and it was indeed those everyday observations. As you know, I work in a newsroom, and for as long as smartphones have been around, and before that, BlackBerries, no reporter can go anywhere without one of those devices, because your editor is always trying to find you, or a source finally gets back to you exactly at the moment when you have to go to the ladies' room. So I would look around at my colleagues and myself and think, you know, they're carrying these phones, but none of us seem very happy about it. And that's the difference between an addictive behavior and a compulsive one. If you're addicted to whatever, roller coasters or whatever, they actually make you happy. You like it in some sense. It gives you pleasure. But when you are compulsively carrying around your smartphone and having to check for texts or tweets or Facebook posts or whatever it happens to be all the time, in so many cases, it's not because of pleasure, it's because of anxiety, the fear that you are going to miss something. Mm. So, you know, this is a very, very common behavior, and it was indeed the sort of instigation for me to do this book, asking how many of the behaviors that we do over and over and over again that we can't seem to resist doing are in fact because we need to drain away what would otherwise be intolerable anxiety, as opposed to because they make us happy, they give us pleasure.
So when I'm on a bus or standing at the bus stop, and there are all those people tapping away at their phones all around me, they're not necessarily looking for distraction or pleasure even. They're anxious?
In many cases, absolutely. And the reason is that the structure, as it's called, the reward structure of texts or emails or a tweet, whatever you're looking for on your phone, is what psychiatrists describe as intermittent and variable, which simply means they're like a slot machine. In a slot machine, you could get orange, lemon, cherry, pull after pull after pull, and you never win. And then suddenly you get, you know, jackpot. So it's completely unpredictable. Same with, let's do texts. You can get one after another after another. And every once in a while, there actually is one that's important. And the other, you are really glad that you didn't miss even for, you know, 2 seconds. So it's that uncertainty that tethers us to the phone. The other thing that's going on here is that more and more of us just simply cannot stand to be alone with our thoughts. And I'll give you just one sort of amazing experiment that pointed this out. Researchers took away the smartphones of a bunch of volunteers, and the volunteers were told, you can either just, you know, sit and stare into space and, you know, think about whatever problems you're having or think about what you're going to be doing tonight, you know, whatever. Or you can give yourself an electric shock. And almost half the people could not stand to just do the daydream introspection thing, and they preferred to give themselves electric shocks.
You're kidding. People would rather give themselves an electric shock rather than just sit there alone?
And that wasn't everybody. It was about half. But still, that's an awful lot of people who just needed the external stimulus of an electric shock rather than just sitting and thinking. Mm-hmm. So something, a similar psychology is going on when we just can't stop looking at our screens.
Well, I know anxiety is on the rise. I think actually your book quotes a bunch of different studies, but it's just recently turned out to be the most diagnosed mental illness on college campuses now. So does that mean that we're living in a country with rising levels of compulsive behavior? Are we all becoming compulsive?
Right. But I think it's just incontrovertible that there are just way more sources of anxiety today than at least, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And whether it's, you know, anxiety over environmental harms or the next terrorist attack, or maybe a somewhat less fraud example, but even something as seemingly inconsequential as online shopping. Used to be, you would go to a store, there was a limited supply, you would have a sense of what the entire supply was, you would make your choice, hand them your credit card, and off you go.
And then came Zappos.
Yes, and then came Zappos, where the number of pages is in the hundreds. So again, right. You know, maybe you're on page 2 and you really like that pair of boots, but something in your brain says, what about page 712? So it's not a surprise that many of us are feeling anxiety. And like the woman who keeps her house controlled and in order to a T, we feel that we have to do one thing in our life to keep it under control, to give us a sense that we have agency, that we have some effect and control on the world. And for many people, it's a compulsive behavior.
Well, this raises such an interesting question about how we label things, how we decide what's pathological and what's normal and what's not. I mean, you point out, for instance, that as a culture, we treat various compulsions differently. So something like hoarding, we ridicule. Something like, say, compulsive exercising or workaholism is admired. So why is that?
Right. So when I describe these behaviors as existing along a continuum on a spectrum, the obvious question is, okay, where at those extremes do you cross from, you know, sort of eccentric or quirky into this is pathological, this is a mental illness? And the best I could come up with was to defer to the official psychiatric explanation, which is this. If a behavior causes distress or impairment, then if it meets other criteria for being extreme, then it is a mental disorder. So in the case of a hoarder, the impairment obviously is that the building inspector will come and condemn your home. If it's keeping your house really, really neat, there is a condition called obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is short of OCD. And OCPD can manifest as extreme conscientiousness, neatness, etc. But if you're just doing those things and it's not causing you distress, it is not impairing you, it's doing the opposite, then it is not an illness, it is not pathological, it is coping.
Mm. You know, one of the things I'm wondering, listening to you, is throughout the course of the 20th century, we've kind of increasingly pathologized different kinds of behaviors that used to be seen as, you know, not necessarily so terrible. So I'm wondering, do you think the compulsions we see have just always been around and now we're just starting to label them as such? Or if you look back in history, I don't know, has compulsive behavior waxed and waned or changed over time?
Well, certainly society's view of it has. And in the past, you know, official psychiatry has not covered itself with glory. It has pathologized, it has medicalized things that are really, you know, I'm sorry, just part of the human condition. And they have learned a lesson from that. So they are pulling back in many cases, not across the board, but at least in some, and recognizing that, for instance, to qualify for a diagnosis of obsessive compulsive personality disorder, OCPD, you have to meet so many criteria. I include a questionnaire in the book. And, you know, if you compulsively put the bath mat just so, and you compulsively do this, and you compulsively do that, you still don't qualify. I mean, you really have to do a lot of these things a lot of the time in order to meet the diagnostic threshold. So, yes, that is absolutely a recognition that humans come in all sorts of varieties. Some of them are a little quirkier. And, you know, we don't want to be in the position that psychiatry was 150 years ago when it called slaves' propensity to escape a mental illness. So that is not a good thing.
Well, we've talked about compulsive behavior as a kind of coping mechanism at the less pathological end. Would you go so far as to say there are good things about compulsive behavior?
There certainly are for society in people who feel compelled to donate a kidney to a stranger. So I have a chapter on good compulsions, and that ranges from people who felt compelled to create art to writers, but probably my favorites were the kidney donors. So when I came across people who donate a kidney to a stranger, I really, really pressed them to ask why they did it. What did they feel, you know, in the months or more leading up to their decision? How did they feel at the moment? And not for everyone, but for a substantial number of them, they described anxiety, knowing that there are people on the transplant waiting list who have to undergo dialysis, and who in many cases die before they get the transplant or who can't tolerate the dialysis. That made them literally anxious. They could not just sit still. They could not stand by knowing that there were people out there in the world suffering whom they could help, and they felt compelled to donate a kidney. So, you know, that's a very specific and stark example of, thank goodness there are people who feel compulsions.
Sharon Begley is the author of Can't Just Stop, An Investigation of Compulsions.